Welcome to an episode of What Matters in North Carolina. As always, I'm your host, Matt Calder, and on today's show, we will be talking with Dr. Robert Lipke, about school choice week in the nation, and more specifically, what's going on in North Carolina as far as school choice week is concerned. We'll hit on the fact that charter schools have now topped 100,000 students enrolled for the first time this year. We'll talk about what's going on to make private school more accessible to different families through different programs like the Opportunity Scholarship Program, maybe some ESA stuff going on and expanding there. If you want to know what ESAs are, you can listen and see. It's education savings accounts, we'll tell you now, but you should listen in and find out more about them as well. Then we'll talk with Susan Myrick about the myriad of cases going on right now in the state regarding redistricting. We got a stay in this case. We're waiting on word about a stay in this other case. We got this judicial redistricting issue going on over here. There's congressional redistricting. There's legislative redistricting. It's a whole big mess and quagmire that we are going to rely on Susan Myrick, who is, of course, the elections and policy analyst over at the Civitas Institute, to sort of unpack a lot of those different things for us to really get us more of a look into what the heck's going on with all of that. So we're going to talk with Susan Myrick about that, and we're looking forward to that one as well. But before we get to any of that, we do have a sponsor who pays for this show, and that is, of course, the Civitas Institute, which is North Carolina's conservative voice. If you want to find out more about what Civitas has going on, go to nccivitas.org, and you can read a lot of stuff there. You can read a lot of the articles by the people we talk about on or talk to on this show often, and you can really find out a lot more over there. Now, before we get into the segments, I want to talk about subscribing to the show. If you're listening on the radio, on the airways, whether you're listening on one of our Saturday stations, our Sunday stations, or maybe you've come to the Freedom Action Network website on a Monday and you've found the show there or throughout the week where we post them up, you're not getting the show in the easiest possible way you could. You could get the show through your phone automatically through one of the podcasting apps. If you're an Apple user, through Apple Podcasts, if you're an Android user, you download one of the many options out there and subscribe that way. But the easiest way to get the show to your device is by subscribing to the podcast, and it will show up on your device automatically. And to do that, just search What Matters in North Carolina on your phone, subscribe, and it'll come to your device. I have mine set up that way for all of my podcasts I listen to, and it is incredibly easy. Now, that does not mean you should totally discount the website, though, because if you do go to the podcasting apps, there's maybe a couple weeks of shows archived there. But if you want the entire history of What Matters in North Carolina at your fingertips, to do that, you should go to freedomactionnetwork.com. And there you can look through the older shows. There's a lot of great evergreen content there with state and national leaders. There's all sorts of great stuff to unpack there and listen to and just go through the descriptions and find out, you know, what interests you. You have some time to kill, just get one of the episodes from there, download it to your phone, download it to your computer, and listen at your leisure. Click on it in the window, however you want to get the show. So that's another way you can hear from us, but we really want to hear from you. And to do that, on one hand, is you can go on our social media for the show and converse with us there. And that's it, What Matters NC on Facebook and Twitter. You can like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, and get all of what we're putting out in between the shows. And also, though, we want to literally hear from you. And to do that, all you have to do is call our call-in line, which is an automated line. You call and leave a message about a minute or two. That number is 919-747-8063. You call in, leave about a minute or two, keep it clean and concise, something you want to talk about, a segment we already did, and you have something to say on it, some comment, or if you want to rant about something that might be a touching point for a segment we do on the show. Again, that number is 919-747-8063. Now, without any further ado, we'll get to our segment with Dr. Robert Lipke. Bob, thanks for coming back on the show.
It's good to be here, Matt.
So you are here this week because it is a special week, and this show will go out this weekend or early next week, but this week where we are right now, recording this, is School Choice Week. We're about to wrap up School Choice Week, right?
Yes, we are celebrating National School Choice Week, which is a big event. It's a national event, and it's been held since about 2011, and it is to celebrate parental options in education. And North Carolina has a very active role in it. And we are having over 1,000 events this week in North Carolina to celebrate school choice.
Right. Yeah, I saw that. And nationally, they're saying there were 32,000 celebrations this week.
That's correct.
Celebrating school choice. So just right out of the gate, remind our listeners what school choice is.
School choice is the ability of parents to pursue the best educational options for their children. And what we mean by that is we start with the premise that all children are different. And that we know that kids need different educational environments. They need different academic environments. They need different environments because they may have special needs. And what school choice says is that we want parents to be able to have the opportunity to put their child in a school that best fits their needs. Now, what we mean by options are that, as everyone knows, there are different types of schools. There are traditional public schools. There are charter schools. There are,
which are also public schools.
That's correct. There are public charter schools. We don't want to people to confuse charter schools with anything other than they are charter schools. Private schools, there are home schools, there are virtual online schools. There are a whole array of options. And what school choice is underscoring and empowering parents, basically empowering parents to be able to choose the best educational option for their children.
Yeah, so if you kind of told me a few years ago, you know, said, you've got, you know, you as a parent have school choice or that sort of thing, I would go, okay, so I can let my kid go to the public school that we're tracked for, you know, or for based on where we live, or I could pull my kid out and put them in private school and bite the bullet and pay those high tuitions over, you know, a public school which comes from our tax money. And I would say those are my options. And then you go, oh, well, I guess homeschool is an option too, which is a fairly new idea in North Carolina. I mean, it's about 30 years old where we've had homeschooling in North Carolina.
Yeah, we've been tracking it since about the mid-80s. But there are over 125,000 students that are homeschooled in North Carolina. So that's
a significant portion. I mean, that's
actually more than private schools.
More than private schools, and that's more than charter schools.
And more than charters, that's right.
But so I would think that those would be your three options. But I mean, you're talking about charter schools, so public schools that are privately run, and then you're talking about, and that's correct, right?
Correct.
And then online schools, and how are those done?
Well, there are in North Carolina, you actually have virtual charter options, and you also have a virtual public school option. So if your child is interested in pursuing education online, you have a couple of options to be able to do that. And that whole community is expanding. I think I wrote on this week, but I think as far as the North Carolina virtual public schools, there's about 58,000 children taking classes in the North Carolina Virtual Public School this past year. So it's a growing community. It's another option. And, you know, if parents want to explore that, we believe that they should be able to. And if many kids flourish in that environment, there are teachers that have a background in training and online education. And I think that can work for a lot of children.
Yeah. So, I mean, it really seems like the choices for parents are growing, which is, I guess, kind of the whole point of school choice is kind of for parents to, I think you said, be empowered to decide what's best for their child.
That's right. And again, as I go back to the premise that all kids are different, you know, they have different needs, they have different talents, they learn it through different ways. And the best education for them, as parents know, is to put them in an environment that best fits their needs. And so what school choice does is it brings those two needs together. It matches, it tries to match, and it tries to give parents access to those best, to those educational options that fit their children in the best way.
All right. So this School Choice Week is just at its heart bringing awareness to the fact that there is an option, right?
That's correct. It's not, it's doing more than increasing awareness, and it's kind of, it's a celebration. If you go onto the website, it's a really interesting phenomenon, because you will have videos from different schools. You know, you can look at things that are going on in North Carolina. They have a homepage, you know, where they take video and photographs from different places that are celebrating school choice and how they're celebrating it. There's events with speakers. As you know, there was an event in North Carolina on Tuesday put right. on by the State Public Charter School Association. And there was about 200 people there. Unfortunately, had to be moved inside because of the weather, but very well attended. But it is, as you said, an event to raise awareness of parental options, but also to let folks know what are going on in all these different schools.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, it's interesting talking about being a celebration, because I think about it, you know, education's very important. Like, to parents, for their kids, who want their kids to get a good education. And that doesn't start with college. You know, I want my kid to get an education. That statement doesn't start with college. And it really, I mean, I guess these parents who take advantage of this ability to maybe direct their kid to a school that they feel is better for them somehow, kind of gives them this sense of relief, sense of that they've improved their child's future. So that is something that is very much worth celebrating.
It is. It's very important. And also implicit in all of this discussion is really the understanding and an agreement on our part that we all acknowledge that parents really have the responsibility for educating their children. And oftentimes part of that is to find the best place for that to happen. You know, at a school that matches their abilities, you know, a school that they feel comfortable at, where they like the teachers, they like the environment, and so forth. But it's a recognition that parents know their children best and know what environment they best can flourish in.
Right, and we were talking about that a little bit before the show, and about how the ability of the parent to choose already engages the parent more. It already brings the parent more to be involved in the school just because of the act that they got to choose where their kid goes.
That's right, Matt, and that's very important, because all the research that you know we've poured over for the last 30, 40 years, one of the most important findings of that is involvement by parents. And if you want to understand how to improve student achievement, how to explain factors in student achievement, family background and involvement by parents is always something that comes to the top of the list when we're looking at that question. And when we have an opportunity for parents to choose that school, whether it be a public charter school, you know, even a traditional public school, a private school, a home school, et cetera, we already, by that choice, we have the parents engaged in that effort and agreeing that, okay, this is where my child's going to be. We agree with, you know, the curriculum that's here. We agree with the teachers that are here. We automatically have buy-in. We have the parents on board. And that's so important, and it's one of the biggest factors to contribute to students' academic achievement. And with choice, you know, choice underscores that, and choice allows parents to actually exercise that right and to make sure that that environment where a parent is bought in is a reality.
Right, and I kind of want to talk about a few you know, what North Carolina is doing and what's different in North Carolina, or changing in North Carolina, kind of for the different areas of school choice. So I guess the low-hanging fruit, you know, we'll start, we already talked a little bit, is the charter schools. And so this year, North Carolina passed a milestone of sorts of enrollment in children in charter schools, hitting that 100,000 student mark, up from 91,000 and change last year. I believe it was 77,000 and change the year before. So really steady, quick jumping growth that really seemed, and thousands of students on waiting lists for charter schools as well. And then new charter schools opening all the time or getting prepared to open. So let's talk a little about why we've seen this explosion of charter schools and then what makes a charter school different than a public school. So first, why are we seeing this explosion in growth?
Well, I think the reason for that is twofold. I think parents are seeing that charters work. They're also seeing that they can provide, in many respects, a more tailored form of education than the traditional public schools. What I mean by that is oftentimes charters are built around certain educational themes, such as math or science, classical education, the arts, and so forth. And charters were one of the reasons they were brought into existence, was to be able to explore those different types of education, a curriculum that is built around specifically those subjects or those themes. And by and large, those forms of education have proved highly successful for the students that have been in them. They're popular, and parents are being drawn to them. So that's one option. The other reason why I believe there's growth is not only because of the popularity, but because people are dissatisfied, and they want a better education for their children. A lot of the growth is driven by parents whose children are trapped in schools that are failing or schools that are exceptionally challenged. That's the reality. They want options, and it's one of the ways that we've been able to help a lot of these kids is to be able to provide other educational options through charters. And that's been driving some of the growth just because of the need. So in answer to your question is, there's a need, and also charters have established themselves that they have a good track record and they're proving popular with parents.
Right. And I mean, I definitely agree that charter schools have a really good reputation from just in my family life, just seeing it that, you know, my wife has said, hey, maybe we can get, you know, my daughter, she's about to turn two. She goes, maybe when she gets up to school, you know, we can get her into a charter school, or, you know, should we put her on a waiting list for a charter school now? Kind of thing, like joking around and talking about. And then her brother and his wife, their two older boys, got accepted to a charter school in the area recently. And I guess they'll be going there next year I don't think they're going to change in the middle of the year, but they'll be going to the charter school. And, you know, they're really excited about that. And it is this good reputation that the charter school is a good place to be. And that really is kind of existing in a way that I kind of thought that just kind of private schools had that. People go, oh, you know, private schools are really good, you know, as a kind of an assumption. And it seems that charter schools are benefiting from that idea.
Yeah, and I think they're also benefiting just from the notion of that. And they've been around, since 1996. But there is still implicit in the idea of a charter that it's an experiment, that it's different, that it's smaller, that you automatically have parent buy-in. There's not a sense of the same level of regulation and bureaucracy, and that's a reality. Parents, I think, largely like the smaller environment. There's less bureaucracy. I think parents, it's been my experience that they feel more heard there, because traditionally, I mean, most of them all are smaller than traditional public schools. And so there's a sense, more of a sense of a community, I think, that is cultivated. Not to say that other places don't have that, but that I think many charters have done a very good job of cultivating that and really being responsive to the needs of parents.
Right. And what I found interesting about charter schools, and I was kind of going over it, being School Choice Week and all, is that the dispersion of not number of charter school students, you know, Wake County and Mecklenburg, Mecklenburg-Charlotte schools dominate in terms of number of students. But what I found interesting is the percentage of students in different counties enrolled in charter schools. And that it's really, with the exception of Durham County, is more rural counties in the state, up towards the northern part of the state and out in Pamlico County, out in the eastern part of the state, having the higher percentage of students in charter schools versus public schools. Not higher than, not the majority, but higher than other areas of the state.
Yeah, that's an area where charters have actually been trying to be more, at least have a greater presence, because as you look as charters have developed, the majority of them have been in urban or semi-urban areas where the population bases are.
Right.
And over the last 10 years or so, they've been almost absent from rural areas. In the last few years, there have been a number of initiatives to, reverse that. And I think in some areas they've had success. And where they have been planted, they have had a dramatic impact on some of the local schools.
I mean, looking at Halifax County, 25.2% of public school students in Halifax County are in charter schools.
Yeah, and we're still dealing with smaller numbers, so the percentages are going to be smaller, right, overall numbers, but they have a significantly larger impact in smaller rural areas than in urban areas.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, there's definitely a smaller number of them. I think I'm looking at these numbers, is about 926 students in Halifax County in charter schools. And I mean, so that's nowhere near the kinds of numbers you're seeing in Wake County. You're talking about more than 10,000 students, yeah, in these charter schools. Or you talk about out in Charlotte, Mecklenburg, even more than that. So you're right that it's a small number, but it's a high percentage. And I just found that really interesting, looking at this map, kind of showing where they were focused in.
Yeah, that is, as I said before, more of an initiative to get charters placed more in rural areas to provide the same opportunities that they provide in urban and semi-urban areas, to have a greater presence in rural areas. So I'm glad to see that's actually happening.
Right, and so that's charter schools, but what's going on in the state to kind of grow or maybe make access to private schools greater, or give to kind of make that another viable choice for parents who maybe didn't have the money to put in for all that tuition beforehand? What's moving the needle for that, to open that avenue of choice up?
Well, the biggest thing that's happened in the last couple of years in the private school area has been the passage of the Opportunity Scholarship Program. That was passed in 2013, and a general outline is that it provides parents, or eligible parents, you know, up to $4,200 to be used for a child's tuition or other educational expenses, primarily tuition. And that's renewable. That program has slowly expanded. As you probably remember, there was a court challenge that was initially brought against it. It survived it. That was, I think the ruling was in 14, so there was somewhat of a cloud hanging over the program. But it has steadily expanded now. In this past year, I believe there were 5,200 kids, I believe, that were in the program that were actual scholarship recipients. In this past year, the legislature voted to expand the budget for scholarships up to, I believe, $44 million, which is a significant expansion. So Those numbers, right now, those numbers will be increasing. Right now, there are about 97,000 children in North Carolina public schools. And as I said before, there are about 5,000 of those were Opportunity Scholarship recipients. We believe that that number will be increasing significantly in the next couple of years.
So that, I mean, that's one way of, it's kind of the state has been pushing this, but there's another plan kind of taking catching some momentum, and that's education savings accounts, right? Those are starting to get a little traction, and that helps with not just private schools, but also homeschooling. It could help as well, depending on how the program is constructed, right?
Yes, and let me backtrack a little bit and make sure that for listeners that the Opportunity Scholarship Program is income limited. It's primarily developed to provide lower middle and lower income people an opportunity to get a good education for their children. And that was the basis of it. And that's still the scholarship is largely targeted on those types of individuals. The ESA program that Matt just alluded to refers to legislation that was passed last year. An education savings account was passed. The legislation is targeted on primarily special needs students. And the program allows eligible recipients, the families of special needs students, up to $9,000 a year. And the parents can use that money for such things as medical therapies, tuition, transportation to and from medical therapies, and other educational expenses. North Carolina is the sixth state to pass an ESA program. Arizona was the first state in 2011. It's proven immensely popular, and since then they've expanded the program to other avenues. In fact, I believe it's statewide now. It was expanded not just from special needs recipients, but to any eligible student there, which is significant. And so this is the first year of the program. If anyone's interested in that, the website, there's program details on a website, and that's the North Carolina State Education Assistance Authority is the organization that has the programs, and they are actually developing guidelines and will determine eligibility and so forth. But anybody interested can go to that website, the North Carolina State Education Assistance Authority. I know that's a mouthful, but I believe, if my memory serves me correctly, it's NCSEAA.com or org, or just Google it. And
I think probably Google the North Carolina
State Education Assistance Authority. It's also the same state agency that administers the Opportunity Scholarship Program.
Okay. So if you want information on either one of those, you can go Google the NCSEAA.
Correct.
And that will get you in the right direction.
Correct.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on and talking with us about school choice and about, you know, private and some homeschool and some charter school options and kind of expanding our awareness of what's out there.
Yes. Thank you, Matt. Just wanted to tell listeners also that on the Civitas website, I've run a couple of articles on school choice this week on the number on options and kind of school choice by the numbers that they can get on the nccivitas.org website this week. That would be, I'm sure, helpful to them. And also, please check the National School Choice Week website for additional details on school choice events in North Carolina.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt.
All right, Susan, thanks for joining us on the show again.
Hello, Matt.
So today we are going to endeavor to unpack the huge quagmire that is North Carolina redistricting cases before different courts on the congressional redistricting, the redistricting for our judges and judicial side, the legislative redistricting for our House and Senate, our local North Carolina General Assembly House and Senate members. There's three different maps, but there's more than three different cases, I believe, on this.
Well, there has been, but we're right down to, without judicial races, we're really focusing on two pieces of litigation right now.
Okay, kind of give us a quick summary of what those are.
Well, one may be packed away, and it was the recent decision by the United States Supreme Court to stay the lower courts, the federal court's decision, to require the legislature to redraw congressional districts yet again. If you remember in 2016, the legislature did redraw the districts.
Right, I remember those meetings because I was sitting through them.
Exactly. And but they came up with a map, and in 2016, if you remember, they also delayed the congressional primaries. And so, but they came up with maps, and they held the elections for the primary and the general election in 2016. And just I think it was January 9th. I think our politically charged federal district court decided on a case that was brought by Common Cause, the leftist group Common Cause, and also the other leftist group, the League of Women Voters, back in 2016. They decided that on January 9th that the legislature needed to redraw maps again due January 24th, 2 weeks. And so Republicans, lawmakers, took that court right to the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, and they sided with the Republican lawmakers and stayed the decision of the lower court. So we'll be using the maps that were used in 2016 once again in 2018.
So they redrew these maps, and then now it's like the 11th hour, and the right. court says, you know, we haven't really said anything about this for the last
year.
For
a whole year.
But now is the time for us to bring it out and say, you know, you really should go ahead and draw some new ones 2 weeks from now.
That's right. So that was one of the cases. The other one is actually on its way to the U.S. Supreme Court right now. It's the case about the legislative maps.
Right.
That's the one that's been a big deal in the last couple of months. A district court, the same district court, Middle District, ruled that the legislative maps rely too heavily on race when they drew them. So the legislature went back to the drawing board and redrew the districts and said that they did not even look at race this time and submitted them. And that court decided that they were going to hire an outside so-called expert, but they call him a special master, to redraw the districts. And when all was said and done, they decided to keep the special master's drawing and instead of the legislature's, which the legislature, if you look at the Constitution of North Carolina, are the ones that are responsible for drawing the districts. So as soon as that court said that they were going to accept the special master's instead of the legislature's, giving really no reason why.
So that's what I was going to say. I was going to say, well, I mean, I'm sure they said, you know, and have these reasons why the legislative districts drawn by the legislature were not up to snuff, were not good enough, were had major problems, maybe took race into account too much, even though they said they didn't do it. Or I'm sure they had a reason why.
They did not. That was very, very strange, because once they looked at the Republican drawn districts, they said that there were a couple of districts that they weren't really comfortable with, but no specifics on even calling the name of the district or what made them think that those, if there were any, districts were drawn too much due to race. And the funny thing is, or funny, you know, not so funny, but strange thing is this special master actually used race a lot more. Well, any amount would be a lot more. Exactly, because Republicans said that they didn't use race at all. So as soon as the middle district said they were going to choose the special masters over the legislatures, the Republican lawyers have gone to the Supreme Court. So we should be hearing from them very shortly.
Right. So right now, as of recording this show, I mean, so the show will go out this weekend. It will go out in early next week for our other you know, our online listeners. So there may be a decision by the time the show goes out. But as of this day, January 25th, we're recording it on Thursday. We do not have word yet on that one.
Right. So then we go to something really new, comparatively speaking, to these vast numbers of legislative district court cases. It's judicial, the judicial redistricting that's really just in the committee stages in the legislature.
Yeah, it's still really an idea. There's nothing too concrete on that, is there?
There really isn't. It is something that is so needed. They've ignored redrawing districts for 50 years and for judicial districts. They'd make little tweaks to lines here and there, but there is a court case out there, and it has to do with what the GOP legislative leaders have done to the primary.
I say, because they haven't done anything to the redistricting yet. How can they be suing them when they haven't done anything? But apparently, it's something different. Okay,
it is what they want to do is not have a primary for these races, for the judicial races that would be affected by redistricting, and instead have a free-for-all.
Which we've had on a minor scale in the last election cycle, I remember.
Right, with one race.
Right.
But the Democrats, the state Democrats and some county district Democrats have decided, they've instituted a lawsuit saying that if we're going to run partisan judicial races, we need to have a primary. So they've taken that to a federal court also. So that'll be an interesting decision by that court, because the GOP had some good arguments against that. They're saying a primary is really a choosing by a party. It's not so much an election, but it's a nomination by a party of a candidate. And so the GOP lawyers were saying, we're not stopping that. The parties can actually have caucus. I mean, a lot of states do that.
Why shouldn't they, honestly? I mean, why doesn't the Democratic Party get together and go, this is our guy, this is our girl, this is our person that we are going to put up for this, and we're going to give all of our support to this person. And anyone else can run. Anyone, any other Democrat can run if they really want to and go through all the hoops to do it. Just as an independent can run. But this is the person we want to win this race. And just support them.
So it's going to be very interesting. You know, the court, there's supposed to be three branches of government, but it appears to me that the Democrats, because they've lost their power in legislatively in North Carolina, that they're trying to substitute the court where the legislature and the lawmakers are supposed to be doing their work, and I don't know if they're winning, but they're doing a good job of taking up the time trying to do that.
And there have been a lot of advancements, I would say, of Democratic, you know, Democrat Party ideals through the courts in the last few years. I mean, I think that the strategy has worked for Democrats.
Absolutely.
Just from looking at it. And they wouldn't be doing it if it wasn't working.
That's right. And it's amazing what you know, it's coming back to those partisan labels on the ballots. Democrats had removed those labels starting in the 90s. They did it incrementally until no judicial races had a party label on them, no candidate. And so people were going to vote and looking at the judges with no information before them, because, well, let's face it, judges don't get out and campaign like regular regular candidates do. They can't.
People do not know who they were voting for.
They do not know.
Or they just weren't voting in those races.
Well, right. Especially when they couldn't see a party label, because many people rely on that party label to tell them something about that candidate. The Democrats knew and know, I believe even so, that the public in general believe Republicans make better judges. They think of law and order when they think of Republicans. So by removing those labels, they kind of left people without information, enough information. So they've made quite a few gains in some of the courts in the last 10 or 15 years. And now that the Republicans have put those labels back in, it may take them a few election cycles to catch up, but hopefully it's giving more people more information about a candidate before they vote or not vote.
Yeah, and I mean, just looking at the way things have gone in the last few years, you know, the perception that Republican judges are tougher on crime and more likely to uphold the law and that sort of thing versus a Democrat judge. And then there's all this funny business going on with the laws.
Yeah.
And a lot of it, though, I mean, you're talking about federal court appointed judges. But still,
they are appointed judges. That's true.
There's some very loose reading of the law going on, it seems like.
I do, as much as Democrats would like to argue that the courts are no place for party, well, but it is. It's an ideology. It's an idea. It's a belief of what the law is, and liberals believe. Their belief on the law is completely different than a conservative. So it's important for the people to know where people are coming from.
Right. And I was sort of, so I'm an unaffiliated voter. I'm not, you know, we don't have an independent party in North Carolina, but I am not a Republican or a Democrat. And I truly believe that I look at the candidates, I look at what their beliefs are, and I make a decision. But that being said, I don't look at every race. I don't look at every candidate as closely as I would look at some different candidates. And having that label does tell you something. And if you have to make a decision, and I don't, in a perfect world, I would know the middle name of every person I was voting for. But I don't have that kind of time. You don't have that kind of time. And most people don't have that kind of time. So any information I can gather is helpful. I've had times when, we were going up to vote or something, and I was voting with my mom, and she goes, well, who should I vote for on this? You know, what do you know about this? Because she didn't know.
That's right.
And I go, well, here's what I know. But having that label does tell you something.
It does. If you don't know and you feel like you need to vote, especially for something as important as a judge, anything helps. Anything does. And to take away information from voters over, you know, eliminating party labels, that was a shame. It was a shame that happened, and I'm glad to see him back.
Right, and I mean, just looking at it, I guess the argument was that judges shouldn't be partisan, but the fact of the matter is that they are partisan.
Right.
Even if you take away the little R or the little D, they are partisan.
Well, it tells you where their belief system is, more than... They're not going to judge a person in the courtroom on whether they're a Republican or
right.
Democrat. But it's going it does give you an idea of what they believe in the law. And I think, again, it was known, especially by Democrats who took away that partisan label, that people rely on Republicans to be good, fair, honest, tough judges.
Right. And so... Didn't it also, though, one of the, I guess, probably unintended consequences of removing the labels, wasn't there a drop in the people who were voting in those races?
Right. And that's just as, that's good for the party that gets out the vote the most. And that's Democrats, of course, because they have nonprofit organizations that's all they do is get out voters, their voters, the ones that they can put the information in their hand and give them something as they go into the polls, the NAACP, Democracy NC, League of Women Voters, Common Cause, all the groups that's their job to turn out their people and set them on that path. So, yeah, definitely, because most people, a lot of people, once they reach a place where they go, I'm not voting for anybody I don't know or don't know about, which that party label helped them, they won't vote.
Right, and they kind of, thinking about it, on the conservative side, you've pretty much got Americans for Prosperity doing a lot of the door knocking.
Right.
But, I mean, there aren't this phalanx of groups lined up, you know, shield to shield, out there putting, you know, getting out the vote.
Right.
On the conservative side.
You know, nonprofits and Civitas is one. There's a limit of what they can do when it comes to party politics. But there is an allowance in the nonprofit rules that if an organization works with an underrepresented or a minority group, then they can do this. Civitas couldn't go out and just turn out vote. We would have to be known to work with an underrepresented or a minority group like the NAACP does and like Democracy NC says they do. So they're given an okay to do that partisan politicking when it's coming to turn out the vote.
Well, sometimes I feel like just the hardworking North Carolinians underrepresented and underserved.
I agree.
The guy who puts his head down and just does what he can.
Yes, absolutely. That can.
So maybe we can do that.
Maybe we can get them to be an underrepresented group. I think that might be a good idea.
But yeah, so kind of recapping, we're waiting on word on a stay on legislative districts.
That's right.
The stay came in for the congressional districts.
That's right. So we'll be using the same map that we did in 2016.
And that's the one that was redrawn without taking race into account.
That's correct.
The one that was kind of sitting on the judge's desk for a year, that's the map that's going to be used?
Yes.
Okay. And which is good to know that that's going to be put to work, because as I said, I sat through all of those very long, very drawn out, very dry meetings.
Sometimes dry, but sometimes contentious, right?
True. It's just, you've been in that room, and the legislative office building is very, very much...
It's like an antiseptic stale.
Yes, it really is. It's very pale colors from the floor
bright
to the
walls
to the ceiling. The lights are the...
Fluorescent
mm-hmm. lights and you can keep that room.
but then the last we're working on right now is judicial redistricting, which is so necessary to do to make it even as far as numbers per district. Right now they've been playing around and adding districts here and adding districts there. So we're really just waiting on that. We'll see if what the court rules. We're depending on them a lot for legislative decisions as to primaries. I mean, I could see them saying that there's got to be a primary, but I kind of agree with the GOP lawyers that we're not stopping parties from picking their candidate.
Right. So. And at the end of the day, it's not that huge of a deal, I don't believe, because I remember when they got rid of the judicial primary, it was because there was judicial redistricting coming down the pike was kind of the plan, or even moving possibly to a new form of selecting judges. But there was a lot of expected change coming that has not originated yet.
Well, and so, they still are talking about getting rid of the election process for judges in North Carolina. I hope that doesn't happen. I think the people should choose their judges.
I think people want to pick their people.
I
think that they don't want an appointment system.
Right.
And I don't necessarily think it'd be a bad system. I don't think it would, you know, be the end of liberty and freedom.
No, I don't either.
I don't think people want it.
But North Carolinians are used to choosing their judges, and I think we shouldn't take that away from them.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on the show and kind of breaking out this whole issue of redistricting for a lot of different cases that
Maybe
are going
we'll,
forward.
We'll be back next week or the week after to talk about the legislative maps.
Oh, yeah, or if they pass judicial maps.
That's right.
So thank you.
Thanks, Matt.
All right, thank you, Susan, for coming on the show and sharing with us everything going on about redistricting in the state. And thank you to Dr. Bob Lipke for coming on and talking to us about school choice and school choice week. Thank you to you, the listeners, for being here with us for another show. And we'll catch you next time.